Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 40 states and the District of Columbia piled into the race for a piece of the Obama administration's education reform riches. They call it Race to the Top. $4.3 billion on the line, and this week, first round, Delaware and Tennessee won. It's real money. Everybody wants it. Everybody needs it. How did these two win? This hour on Point, we're talking with the winners of the federal government's Race to the Top Education Reform Initiative. You can join the conversation. Was your state in the running? Is it still? And what's the message in Delaware and Tennessee winning round one of Race to the Top? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, let's hear from the winners. From Nashville, Tennessee, we're joined by no less than the governor of Tennessee, Phil Bredesen. The Federal Department of Education announced on Monday that Tennessee has won $500 million-plus dollars for education reform. Governor Bredesen, congratulations and welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you. This has been a very good week for Tennessee.
No doubt. We're going to hear all about it and look forward to it. And with us from Delaware is Daniel Cruz, Deputy Secretary of Education for the state of Delaware. He was right in the middle of pulling together the state's Race to the Top application. Delaware has won $100+ million for its much smaller number of schools. Daniel Cruz, congratulations to you and Delaware, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom. Glad to be with you all.
So Secretary of Education Artie Duncan says that they were looking for systemic change, and you two represent it. How so? Governor, what did Tennessee put up here that you think put it in the winner's circle?
I think there were a couple things here in Tennessee. I mean, first of all, we have been working on and I think had a coherent plan to make some real change. What we're trying to do here is not just kicking the can down the road a little further, but trying to step back and really take some different directions. I think that was number one. And number two, I think it was important. We did an awful lot of work to just get everybody on board. This is not my program. It's not a Democratic or Republican program. There's a lot of shared interest in both parties and everyone from the teachers union to the business community. And that, I think, gives it the kind of staying power through administrations and over time that they were looking for.
Now, I'm sure that every governor said something like that to the education department, but you won in Tennessee along with Delaware. What do you think were the nuts and bolts pieces of this? When you get down to assessment, evaluation, teacher compensation, what do you think were the elements that pushed you over the line?
Well, I think first of all, Tennessee has a very good and long-standing, robust data system. We've been doing value-added assessments longer than anybody else in the country. So
you can assess outcomes.
Where you assess the value-added, how much a student learns during the course of a year down at the student level.
Okay.
And so it's not something that we're proposing to do next year. It's something we've been doing for literally two decades now. That certainly was a huge help in putting this whole thing together. I feel good about it. I think it was a good proposal, and we had some of the elements. The other thing is that we called our legislature into special session in January. And on several things they were looking for, like the legal ability to use assessment data in the evaluation of teachers, including tenure decisions, we passed it. I mean, it's not something we were promising for the future. It's something we could present as a done deal, and that's what they were looking for, which is not promises, but but anything else. And the third thing I'd say is just that we didn't do this as a, this is not a demonstration project. We didn't pick a few districts. We're long past the point of, you know, doing pilots and doing demonstrations. We know what we have to do over the next, you know, certainly decade, I think. And we put the whole state in. Some people told us that was a disadvantage, but every school district in the state is participating, and we're in this one together. I think they liked it.
Arne Duncan pointed to that as one of the reasons in both cases that they liked the applications of Tennessee and Delaware, that it touched every part of public education in the state. Daniel Cruz, you're listening to Governor Bredesen there in Nashville. What about in Delaware's case? What do you think are the key elements that put you in that winner's circle of only two people that thought there might be more in their first round, but it's just you and Tennessee? How'd you do it, Daniel?
Sure. I think there were really two organizational points that jumped out, at least we felt from our application, and I guess it's evident in the scoring as well, that with each of our reforms within the four assurances, they really do thread together. One doesn't stand alone. They're all interdependent. And the fact that all in total that those initiatives would touch every single school in our state, you know, we were very fortunate that we think we were able to demonstrate what we're kind of calling the three C's, the collaboration, the courage, and the capacity, in that every single possible signatory that could sign on to the application did. So we had every single school board president, every single district superintendent, every single charter director, every single charter board president, and really critical to this was every single local union president as well. So I think the combination of showing that all of our initiatives were interdependent and threaded together, you know, with the fact that we had 100% sign-on showed that we could really take all of these reforms as a total package to scale across a whole state and be able to kind of demonstrate to USDOE and to our fellow states that you can do this at a statewide level from the top to the bottom. And I think that was a critical point we tried to drive home in our written application. And then in our interview, I know our folks on the interview panel made particular points to show that we're talking about the total application, all reforms to all schools everywhere in our state.
This sign-on, buy-in from all the parties, including teachers' unions, seemed to be very important. What about the key elements that they and others had to buy in to? What did you put on the table in Delaware, Daniel Cruz?
So in Delaware, we had two state board regulations that passed prior to submission of our application. And one of those dealt with our teacher evaluation system. We were fortunate that for a number of years we've had a single teacher evaluation system across our entire state. We were able to drive some reform through our State Board of Education regulation process.
Does that mean consequences for the evaluation or what?
Sure. It means the ability for reward and for consequences. So when we look at the student improvement domain in the teacher evaluation system, the way it's been reformed now, and that's reflected in the different initiatives in our application, is that a teacher has to show demonstrated student improvement or else they are automatically ineffective or needs improvement. However, if they do show student improvement, they are automatically at the effective level. We added a level called highly effective. So what we're really doing is driving the focus with an extreme laser-like focus on the student improvement category.
And that effective label, is that required for tenure? Is that the weight in it?
So we have pending tenure legislation. We talked about that legislation in our application. However, we didn't have that move forward in time before submission of the application. But all through our application, we're talking about now using that evaluation, the results of that evaluation, to drive different decisions in our state, whether it be tenure, whether it be promotion, whether it be bonus or career stepladders, to really drive that change in our state to see it as a valuable and fair evaluation and one upon which critical decisions should be made.
Governor Bredesen, how did you get union buy-in in Tennessee? Some real front-runners, people had talked about Florida and Louisiana, had much lower, 8% of union buy-in in Florida. Yours is reported as much higher. How did you do that?
Yeah, we, to be honest with you, just spent a lot of time working on it. I'm 7 years and change into my eight-year term I'll have as governor. But we've done a lot of things with education. I think the unions trusted me. We've dealt with a lot of issues that they've had. We've worked to get funding into education here in Tennessee, but it took a lot of work. I mean, these are very uncomfortable places from where teachers' unions are. Are traditionally, but we worked hard at it, and I think that the fact that there was such broad support for it, both the Democrat and Republican and everything else, helped them to come on board with that. One of the things that we did, for example, is a particular challenge we have is I'm term limited out and won't be here next year. And how do you assure continuity? We had, at the time, 7 announced candidates from both parties for governor. I got each and every one of the 7 of them to sign a letter as part of our application saying that they were fully in support of it and, would carry forward. And I think those kinds of things help give people comfort that we were doing it, and help give the unions comfort in giving it a try. Now, that doesn't mean there's not going to be, over the next few years, there's not going to be frictions anywhere. I mean, I can't say that every business is going to like everything we do, or every union member is going to like everything. But I think we've started out being on the bus together, and if we need to stop once in a while and change the seats around and reassess, we're going to do that. But I think anytime you do anything like this, where you have to sustain it over a period of time to make it work, you have to have broad buy-in. These are not the kinds of things you can do with some narrow where you have 51% of the people supporting.
Right. It's like education that all over. And what do you think about the race to the top dynamic, Governor, as a way to get states buying into this? I mean, it's a fair amount of money. You've got $500 million headed your way.
Yep.
Only 2 winners this time, but they've got lots and lots of states trying, which I guess is maybe it's a pretty effective way of propagating policy change.
I have to say, I think they've done a wonderful job on this. I've been a little, as a governor, I've been a little grumpy about the health care stuff. I think this is something where they've just done it really beautifully. I mean, the special session that we had where we got these things done, they gave us the hook we needed to just get over the top. So even if we had not won any money in this, it would have already been of enormous help to us in the changes we're already making in our state. The other thing I'd say about it is, when it started, I wasn't, you're at least a little skeptical about how political or not political it's going to be. We are not a swing state, so if it got real political, I don't know if it would have been good for Tennessee. I have to say, as it got up in the final weeks, I thought they just turned absolutely square corners. I mean, everything was done absolutely above board and openly and stuff, and it just to me was a model of how you ought to do something like that.
There's a great winner's view. Governor Bredesen, please stand by, and Daniel Cruz in Delaware. Tennessee and Delaware, big winners in Race to the Top. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour with the first winners in the federal Race to the Top initiative for American schools, Delaware and Tennessee. Never mind March Madness in basketball. There's been a huge competition to see who can be the most ambitious, the most effective in looking at overhauling education in the individual states. Lots of other finalists here: Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Kentucky, Louisiana, Massachusetts, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and South Carolina. But at the top of the heap, Delaware and Tennessee. Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen is with us for a few more minutes today. His state won $500 million in its Race to the Top winner's circle. Daniel Cruz is here, Deputy Secretary of Education in Delaware. Delaware took home $100 million, $3 billion plus still out there to be won. We're joined right now as well from Washington by Grover Russ Whitehurst, Director of the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. Grover Russ Whitehurst, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me. I'm pleased to be here, and congratulations to Delaware and Tennessee for their great applications and their great wins.
Absolutely. Big congratulations. What do you see as the message here? What is being valued by this Obama Department of Education as illustrated in these victories, Russ?
Above everything else, the ability of states to put in place systems for evaluating teachers and principals based on achievement gains of their students. It was the ability of the states to indicate that they were able to do that, their legislatures able to pass laws that would put consequences in place that I think pushed these 2 states over the top, coupled with the data systems they have, which allow that kind of assessment.
But we've just been talking about how the Obama administration is moving away from No Child Left Behind. So if you're not testing and evaluating that way, what's the data and how do you use it? That seems like a No Child Left Behind dynamic.
It is, and what the administration has made quite important here is that states sign on to a common standards effort. So the administration is, in fact, not moving away from assessment. They are, in some sense, strengthening assessment and insisting that as many states as possible have the same standards and same assessment systems.
And other top priorities here, we read autonomous public charter schools, revamping teacher pay and evaluation, and in addition to the data, did Delaware and Tennessee deliver on these other fronts?
Well, they certainly delivered on evaluating teachers and providing consequences based on performance. This includes who you hire, who you tenure, who you promote, what kind of rewards are available or bonuses that are available for performance. So both states committed to basing a significant portion of teacher evaluation on performance in the classroom, defined as raising student achievement on test.
Let's get some calls. Governor Bridgeson, we've got calls from your home state. We've got Tom in Waverly, Tennessee. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Tom. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Phil Bridgeson, I just wanted to call and congratulate you and the entire state. As a local artist and as born and raised Tennessee, and I've seen how the education system has changed. I remember going through it, and I've seen it now. And I know it's difficult. I know it's difficult for teachers, and I know it's difficult for students. But I really appreciate the changes that the state has made to make it better for the students. It's greatly appreciated, and I know that you'll be missed when your term is over.
A high five from one of your constituents, Governor. I mean, it's true that Tennessee has had some pretty low rankings over the years in terms of where it stacks up in the state rankings, and
no,
here you come out at the top.
I'll tell you, I think one of the real the money is wonderful. And we're going to use it well. It's going to make a real difference. But if just, being selected in this way gives people in Tennessee, a kind of much more of a sense of the possibilities in our education system and we really don't have to stand here with our hands in our pockets and think about being 40-something and so on, that we're doing the right kinds of things, this verification, that in the long run could be even more important than simply the money.
Let's go to Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm very jealous.
you and a lot of others.
Yeah. Iowa, on our state quarter, is a schoolhouse, and we used to be top in the nation for education, and we're not anymore. And I think that if there's still money available, that our lawmakers and our citizens need to step up and put the pressure on. Our legislative session just closed, and we managed to, not fire that many people, I guess, and there's still maybe some raises to be had for some teachers, but it was a scary time for a lot of teachers here, and a lot of people galvanized to, support the arts in schools and stuff like that.
Laura, did you feel a race to the top, competitive fever in Iowa, or was it not so high on your state's agenda?
Well, I feel terrible saying this, but I don't really, I kind of remember a little bit of hearing about it, but I don't think it was really on a large scale on the radar here, and that's really sad. It should be.
Of course, these victories help put it on the radar. I guess that's part of the strategy, and heaven knows, there's a lot of need out there around the country. Laura, thanks for your call. One more right here from Essex, Vermont. Carrie, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Hi.
My comment has more to do with the general direction that Arne Duncan seems to be promoting about grants and funding being tied to competition. In the past, the education laws would sort of lay out the goals, and the states were left to figure out the best way for them to reach them.
Yep.
Now it's we're being told what to do, and if you want the money, you will do it. So it's really not competition. It's a mandate. And the states can't, for the most part, operate the educational system without federal funding. So it's really an arm twist in disguise. And then I don't think all of the states necessarily had things that weren't working. Vermont's got some of the highest reading and math scores in the country,
mm-hmm.
for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my comment. Thank you.
That's very interesting, Carrie. Thanks for your call. Daniel Cruz, how about it? Is this Is this a big arm twist? I mean, you and Governor Bredesen in Tennessee and Delaware, you're winners.
Yeah, that's a good point, Tom. You know, actually, I would respectfully disagree with the caller from Vermont. The race to the top, this competitive grant opportunity, is actually something that supplements what's already out there in the formulaic distributions that come from USDOE. There have been no decreases in Title I funding or the traditional general allocation funding that most states are used to. This is simply opening up another door and another avenue for the administration to drive us to certain points.
But in such fiscal hard times, a lot of people are seeing money go away. Everyone's surely hungry for what would be in that extra bucket of cash, big bucket of cash.
Sure, and I think that's a valid point to make. However, I think doors aren't necessarily closing from the federal level around a lot of the traditional funding, certainly that goes to our high-need schools. If anything, those opportunities around the school improvement grants and Title I are actually increasing, and those are formulaic. You get those given the number of students that hit that qualification. This is simply a high stakes and a high-value competitive opportunity to supplement and to seed some other new innovative ideas in other states. So, and to the point earlier, I'm sure Tennessee would agree, what we plan to do in Delaware, certainly I would think in Tennessee as well, is given that we are fortunate enough to be the two that were selected in this round, is that we plan to share everything that we learn with all states. In fact, Tennessee and Delaware will both be at a technical assistance conference, I believe in a couple weeks, where sponsored by USDOE, where we can begin to share out more details and intricacies of our applications to try to help the next round of applicants be more competitive, as we've learned from the evaluation of our applications. So I know we have a very firm commitment to share our successes and maybe even more important, to share our challenges as we go through the process, so that while the funding for round one may be in Tennessee and Delaware, the lessons that we'll learn will be shared across the nation, which I think is a critical point for us to drive.
Governor Bredesen, I know we've just got you for another minute. What do you say to our caller from Vermont who says, hey, we're working hard up here, but this is a kind of arm twisting out of Washington because everybody's hungry, everybody needs it.
I understand the concern, but again, I think I would respectfully disagree with that as well. And obviously, you're talking to two of the winners here, we're perhaps not as unbiased as somebody else might be. But I mean, I've spent 7 years as governor, explaining to everybody every time they would listen that we don't chase grants. I mean, we have strategies in our health department, in our Medicaid program, in education. And we're executing those strategies, and where the federal government is able to help us, we'd like their help, but we don't chase grants. On this one, I mean, the basic thrust of what they were doing, I'm a former businessman, but, you know, the idea of saying you have to have ways of evaluating the performance of professionals, you got to get rid of the legal impediments to doing that, you got to do it sensibly, is just, you know, that's managing human capital 101. What they were proposing to do, I think, is just, you know, is a very straightforward kind of thing. I mean, the notion of saying you have to have good data systems, you have to evaluate objectively the performance of people you're paying a lot of money to teach your children, is not exactly radical. It's like a very common sense notion, and we were happy to sign on to it.
Governor, can you take one more call from Tennessee?
Sure.
Pall Mall, Tennessee, Georgia, you're on the air with Governor Phil Bredesen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I newly moved to Tennessee. I live in Pickett County, which is right next door to Fentress County, which is, both of them are very depressed areas. And recently the York Institute in Fentress County has been told that they will close next year. The teachers have all been given pink slips because this is a state-funded school, and they are not going to receive state funds next year. And I wonder if any of this money might possibly be going to help out York Institute.
Georgia, we've got it. Governor Bredesen, I'm sure that's not the only sort of rifle shot question there. People are going to say, hey, how about that money for my backyard, sir?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I appreciate that. We have in Tennessee one school which is entirely state-funded, and in this tight budget year, we have said that we will provide as much money per student to York Institute as we provide to any other school in the state, but that the local government share of that has got to be provided in those counties as well. It may well get deferred in the budget process for a year or two, but ultimately we need to correct that situation. You know, one thing I would just add as I go here is that one of the important things of this for us is so much of education reform discussion has been about urban schools, and, you know, frankly, most of the people who talk about who talk about education policy, they live in areas where there's urban schools. They live in Washington, mm-hmm. New York, and Boston, and the like. In Tennessee, the rural school systems are it's really important that we deal with them, and it's a totally different dynamic. I mean, you have to be much more committed to professional development as opposed to sorting the wheat from the chaff from the teachers. If you have a school in Appalachian County where you have a terrible time recruiting teachers to even be in the school, you know, the notion of saying we're going to just get rid of teachers who don't work, it doesn't work. If you have three schools in a district saying you're going to close a non-performing one, doesn't work. And one of the things I really liked about this whole approach was it really was taking a very constructive approach. They were urging a constructive approach toward professional development and the development of skills in teachers rather than simply, if you don't perform, you're out of here. And it works really well for us in those rural areas.
Well, we share our congratulations with you today, Governor Phil Bredesen of Tennessee. And thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Governor Phil Bredesen there from Nashville. More questions for you, Daniel Cruz and Russ Whitehurst in Washington. Roberta in Ithaca, New York. Roberta, you're on the air.
Hi. You talked about assessing teachers by the growth of their students, and I wondered what kind of assessments you were doing. Is it just standardized testing, or are there other measures?
Daniel Cruz in Delaware?
Sure, that's a great question, and that's in our state board regulation that now is requiring that teachers show student growth to be effective or highly effective. What's also delineated in that regulation is that we take the next 18 months and actually sit down with those professionals and help develop what some of those measures will be. We've committed to, regardless of the subject, whether it's one of the state-tested four subjects or whether it's a subject that it's less easy to put your finger on how you would evaluate, whether that be art, physical education, foreign language, or let's say an instructional coach that floats between buildings. What we have initially talked about, and we will continue the conversation when we sit down with those professionals, is that it's not just about the state standardized test. Our state test that we're beginning, we have a new state test actually that will be rolled out next year that's an online adaptive test that can be given multiple times throughout the year so we can have multiple measures. We've committed to multiple measures for all of those subjects, knowing that one measure isn't the fair way to evaluate something that has such uber importance in a teacher evaluation. So we're looking at benchmarks off of our state test. We're looking at benchmarks created by teachers in districts and charters. We're talking about summative as well as formative opportunities for measuring that growth. Inherent in all of that and in the regulation is the sense of fairness through this. If we don't drive that sense of fairness from the principal to the teacher to the paraprofessional, then we're never going to have the opportunity to really move the needle as we'd like to in our state. So there's no one single answer because we don't think it's fair to have one single measure when it comes to something like measuring student growth for a teacher for their evaluation.
Russ Whitehurst in Washington, what about this nationally? With the big emphasis on evaluation still, post No Child Left Behind, I guess, where do you see that pushing the evaluation? Is that standardized testing? Is it multiple measures, as Daniel says? And what does that really mean?
I think most states and districts will go for an approach like that just described for Delaware that is collaborative and involves building measures that generate a fair amount of buy-in from those who are being evaluated. It's clear that at the level of the executive branch in Washington, as well as the pragmatics of developing evaluation systems, you need to have a strong component be that which is already there, which is standardized testing. And so I think you'll see as these systems develop around the country that they will rely significantly on the existing tests as well as new tests that are coming online. Those are developed, they're reliable, we know what they predict. And it's easier to start there and build around that than it is with the development of something brand new.
Delaware and Tennessee got buy-in from their unions. A lot of states have not. I mean, do you expect nationally to see union resistance to what's being pushed with the Race to the Top?
Oh, absolutely. And there's an interesting dynamic going forward for the states that were on the bubble but didn't quite get there. And that is the trade-off between buy-in and courage, as Mr. Cruz described it. So we've got states like Florida that had very bold plans that generated not a lot of union buy-in. Mm-hmm. Do they water down the plans to get buy-in, or do they stick with what they've got and hope they'll be more successful in the next round. I think that's an interesting decision that states will have to make strategically going forward.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking this hour with the first winners in the federal Race to the Top initiative for American schools, Delaware and Tennessee. Delaware came in number one. Daniel Cruz, the Deputy Secretary of Education for Delaware, is with us this hour from Dover, Delaware. Grover Whitehurst is with us as well from Washington, Director of the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. We're happy to have had Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen with us. Let's get a call from Belmont, Massachusetts, and Edward. Hi, Edward, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. First, I wanted to say that I do agree with and appreciate the effort of the President and Secretary Duncan and the whole administration to put real funds behind the effort. But I have a pair of associated concerns. One is the heavy reliance on charter schools or the charter school principle that ultimately, as I see it's implemented, gives those schools the ability to exclude students who don't fulfill the ambitions of the school. And on the other hand, and that ends up being an unfair sort within any given state, for example.
Kind of cherry-picking the student population.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there's an absence, in my mind, of emphasis on what used to be called vocational training, but just the practical training for, you know, those students who will compete perhaps not to the very top. I have two teenage boys, mm-hmm. one who is now in university, and what we saw was that a lot of the testing and the practical program, be it in science, math, history, whatever, are not focused on, and Belmont has a very good school system, are not focused on, if you want, practical skills as much as on the higher level skills necessary to get into an Ivy League college or something.
Right. That's a great question, Edward. I appreciate your raising it. Let's go to number one winner, Delaware, first. I mean, Daniel Cruz, what about it? What happens to that tier, that population of your students for whom maybe practical training is maybe more important?
Sure. I think that those are both two good questions. I'd like to kind of take a shot at both of them, actually, mm-hmm. and give some Delaware context to it.
Mm-hmm.
First, and a little more direct around the charter school piece, we do have a very robust charter school law in our state of Delaware, and there is certainly criticism out there about the cherry-picking piece. And the way we've dealt with that in our state is that our law is very prescriptive in that there has to be an open lottery process because our charter schools are indeed public schools just like traditional districts are. So in an attempt to address that, that is how we've legally tried to address that concern, because it is a valid concern and one that in Delaware we've tried to address. And hopefully now that we have this national platform, we can help other states look at how we've addressed it, not that it's the only or the magic way.
Do you avoid the cherry-picking problem with your approach somehow?
When I say the open lottery process, that means any student can apply to be a part of that school.
Mm-hmm.
It's not selective by GPA or entry exam or things of that nature.
Okay.
So I think we'll have a platform to kind of share our experiences mm-hmm. with that, which would be good for the issues raised by the caller from Massachusetts. And then again, with the vocational piece, I think the USDOE, the federal government, has actually driven us to look at not only college-ready but career-ready as well, whether it be standards or programs or avenues for folks who, for whatever reason, may not be on the college track but certainly want to be on the career track, so that all of our students are graduating ready to take on one or the other, if not both.
But how does that come into play on the evaluation side? They may have good career skills but won't necessarily push your testing median up. I don't know.
Sure. And so how one way that we look at this in Delaware is we have our traditional school districts, and in that mix are also three vocational technical education school districts where our students can elect to go into more very specific career pathways in mm-hmm. their school districts.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly still receive the regular education form as well that's tested. And I would venture to say that any occupation today that we would want to drive our students towards pursuing would need to reflect the skill set that's learned and that's taught around reading, writing, adding mathematics, science, and social studies. So are the career, the open career opportunities and the new career opportunities today are ones in which you have to have a mastery of those skill sets. So as we teach those in our vocational school districts, and by the way, also certainly in our traditional school districts mm-hmm. and charter schools, we're actually preparing our students not only for the college readiness piece that we're talking about, but we're giving them the fundamentals that will make it essential for them to pursue and be successful at a well-paying career position as well when they graduate from after their K-12 experience. So I would say the testing is certainly important for whichever line you're going to go after for the college or career ready.
Russ Whitehurst, what about the charter school front here? Any number of states have moved to ease limits on these autonomous public charter schools in the race to the top. Is that emerging as a central goal for Arne Duncan and President Obama?
Yes, they've been very clear on that from the beginning. And to go back to the caller from Vermont, there's obviously arm twisting and getting states to go along with that agenda. Mm-hmm. When Secretary Duncan's been challenged on this, he has said, I'm not in favor of charter schools. I'm in favor of good charter schools. But nationally, charter schools on average do about as well as regular public schools. So the secret for both charter schools and regular public schools is how to go from bad to mediocre to best, and we don't have that secret recipe yet.
Let's go to Greg in Beverly, Massachusetts. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
In sort of relation to your guys' point, I was curious in whether or not you take a look at socioeconomic factors and other issues relating to the environment of these schools as to whether or not they need to change. And it's my understanding that schools don't necessarily fail because the teachers are bad or because the curriculum is not working. It's more related to poverty and income levels in the community and things like that. I'll take my answer off air.
Thank you very much, Greg. Daniel Cruz, how does Delaware take that into account?
Sure. I'll tell you in a couple ways. The first initial response I would have is that I respectfully disagree with that as well. There are students that are high poverty, high minority that are high achieving. We have 90-90-90 schools that put that myth that if you come from that background, you are unable to learn to rest by data. So the way we do look at how we address different populations of schools in the classroom, if we take it back to the teacher evaluation, not only do we need to have fair measures regarding the subject matter that teacher provides in the classroom, mm-hmm. we also intend in Delaware to engage in the discussion and have it reflected in the outcome of those measures, the categories of students that might be in that room. Because they present different challenges. You could have a room that, regardless of the subject, it could be an AP classroom or a room that is filled with students who, through their testing, are already at the top of all scores, whatever type of measure you'd like to use. However, we're still requiring that you show a certain amount of growth in order to be rated effective or highly effective. There might be a unique challenge in that classroom because of that population of student. Could be the same if you have a different type of population. So where we will are looking to have that conversation around the population of students and how that affects the teaching and learning in the school is around that type of topic. Not to say that we're not going down the path of saying when you have this type of population, they cannot learn. We do firmly believe that having well-prepared and well-supported teachers is the critical factor, whether you have gifted advanced students or years behind students in the classroom.
But you've put extra focus here, Daniel Cruz. I mean, for one thing, as I understand your application, you're promising to, ID the worst performing schools in the state and then turn them around within 2 years. So you're...
Yes.
And you're also giving extra bonuses to teachers and principals who go into those challenged schools.
We are incentivizing. We're trying to attract and retain some of our teachers who are rated the most highly effective to move into those schools and to the schools of the highest need and to encourage them and provide them with adequate supports to help them do the good job they were doing in, let's say, a non-high need school in this high need school and to help with the other professionals in that building to raise the level of achievement. So traditionally, at least in our state, we have not had very clear-cut incentives to do that other than teachers that do it out of the goodness of their heart wanting to move into those buildings. And so what we're committed to doing is not just focusing on the dollar to get those teachers in and keeping them there, but trying to also create a very positive professional environment for those teachers, because studies have shown time and time again that money is important – but for adults to feel that they're in a nurturing and productive adult environment in that teaching setting is just as important, if not more important. So we're trying to hit it from both ends.
Let's get a call from Enterprise, Alabama. Joshua, you're on the air, Joshua.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question as to what either one of, whether it be Delaware or Tennessee, did in regards to homeschooling programs. You know, what kind of special provisions they might have made for homeschoolers, because that is a way that helps to take some of the load off of the public school system.
Yeah, Joshua, let us look at it. And thanks. Russ Whitehurst, does homeschooling come into play here? I mean, these are dollars going to public schools, so is homeschooling, like, not in the picture here, or is it part of it? Do you know?
It's not in the picture. I've not read all the applications, but those I've looked at had nothing about homeschooling involved. And homeschooling has shown explosive growth over the last 20 years, and more kids being homeschooled than are in charter schools. So it's part of a burgeoning kind of choice movement by parents wanting something that the regular public schools aren't providing and seeking it out and having it for their kids.
So it's in the mix, whether it's in the applications or not. Kathleen in Canton, Massachusetts. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a very specific question about libraries and schools.
Okay.
I'm a school librarian, and I was wondering whether Delaware or Tennessee have specific standards in their states that are also included in their proposals, where school libraries are full partners in collaboration with the teaching, and they have outcomes and assessments that they expect for information literacy for their students.
Kathleen, do you feel libraries under pressure these days with the fiscal situation?
Yes, I think they're under a lot of pressure, but I also think that a lot of people don't understand their role in schools. And the fact that the teacher librarian is a very qualified teacher and is one of the leaders in 21st century skills and teaching the kids about information literacy, which is so important.
Kathleen, we've got it. Librarian power. Daniel Cruz, how about it? In your application, do school libraries make an appearance?
So we don't specifically identify school libraries, but we are certainly committed and do agree that we view our libraries kind of as the nucleus of resources in a school building. And what we've tried to do in our application in every case possible is to be as least prescriptive as possible as to how our individual districts and charters will choose to hit the goals and hit the benchmarks in our Race to the Top application. However, it's certainly open, and we would encourage those districts and charters to really take a sharp focus on what I'm calling the nucleus of our resources in our buildings, because in certain buildings you can walk in and you can tell, you can instantly see that they're being that those areas are being respected and viewed in that fashion, and in other buildings you can see that there really is not that focus on that opportunity there, whether it be technology, whether it be access, and multiple integration from different subjects and teachers and classes to use that resource. So we will certainly encourage that type of work in our state.
I've got a web comment here from Peter. Let me put to you and Russ. Peter writes, I have a bright, passionate 3-year-old grandchild. I do not want her to attend a school nor be taught by teachers whose performance is measured by student achievement on tests. I want her to be a passionate learner, a thinker, a doer, even a dancer. Will Race to the Top produce a school for grace? I don't hear that, says Peter. Daniel Cruz in number one Delaware, what do you say to Grandfather Peter?
Sure, I think that's a very valid point, and you're right. A lot of this discussion, focus, and reform has been around the student improvement component, the student achievement component of evaluation systems. We haven't had a lot of conversation, and this is a great opportunity to share the rest of the conversation, that at least in Delaware, our teacher evaluation system has 5 components, not just one. The fact that the focus has been drilled in on this one component is because some could view that component in some states has not reached its full potential.
Name the others beyond testing.
Sure. There's professional development. There's school climate. There's classroom maintenance. And there's preparation and planning as well. So there are opportunities within the other 4 outside of the student improvement or student achievement domain for the types of issues that the web called, the person who sent in the question via the web, for principals to evaluate teachers and to drive and reward that type of success.
Russ Whitehurst, how about it for parents and grandparents who, you know, describe their children as passionate learner, thinker, doer, even a dancer? Does the program being pushed and raced to the top, you know, encourage the kind of education that sort of grandparent might want to see?
It doesn't discourage that kind of education, but it doesn't emphasize it or place measurement tools in place that would allow schools and teachers to be evaluated in terms of their success at that level. There's no question that the federal involvement historically and in a continuing sense has focused on children from disadvantaged backgrounds. And so where we've seen progress over the last 7 or 8 years, it has been at the lower levels of performance. But I think we can depend on the leadership in schools and districts and teachers to continue to focus on kids who want to be creative, who are of high aptitude, who need special experiences. But that leadership is going to have to come, I think, from the local and state level rather than from the federal level.
About $3.5 billion still to be ladled out in Race to the Top. Lots of states will still be pushing for that. What do you think? What the profile of education in America that leverage in this competition is likely to produce? In a nutshell, Russ, are American schools in this competition and under its influence will be more what?
They'll be more controlled from the priorities of the executive branch in Washington. Under the Stimulus Act, Congress gave the Secretary of Education $5 billion to play with, and I admire very much his boldness in using that money and the execution of the department in putting plans into place and carrying them out. But there's no question that it portends a very fundamental shift towards top-down federal control if we continue along this path. And the administration has already made it clear that it wants to make a Race to the Top competition permanent so that it would happen every year. When you get to decide the terms of the competition, who will win based on what they're doing, you have a lot of money on the table. There's no question that it gives a lot of control to Washington. And while I endorse this secretary's priorities, I worry about that shift, what it would mean with a different Secretary of Education or what it means for the traditional process in which Congress decides what the federal government will do.
Grover Whitehurst at the Brown Center on Education, the Brookings Institution, thanks very much for being with us. Daniel Cruz, in a word, do you feel imposed on or freed with your victory?
I think we feel a unique opportunity to show in Delaware how we can balance these federal priorities that we've been talking about with a true and thorough sense of fairness for the children and for the adults that teach the children. I think that's the story of Delaware's application, and I think that's the lesson that we'll be sharing out across the country over the course of the grant.
Daniel Cruz in Delaware, number one in round one of Race to the Top. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.